Today's Teisho will be on case 20 in the Wumenquan, the Mumonquan. Case 20 is entitled The Man of Great Strength. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a man of great strength does not lift his legs? He also said, it is not with the tongue he speaks. Mumon's comment, it must be said that Shogen shows us all of his stomach and intestines, but alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him severely. Why? If you want to find pure gold, you must see it through fire. Mumon's verse, lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth dhyana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. Now, someone else write the last line here. Today is the second day of our August 2012 Sesshin. This morning, I was thinking about the 2011 Sesshin, which didn't happen. I was not sure that we would have the critical mass for Sesshin, enough attendance to make it possible to have one. And so I decided to wait until October. And at any rate, we had you might not remember, but we had a hurricane. And it actually caused major flooding down here. And they closed this area. They closed Murray Grove on what would have been the second day of our Sesshin. So we would have gotten here, unloaded everything, gotten up, recited the sutras, started breakfast, and been told to leave. So I wish I could tell you that my amazing Zen master powers told me that this was going to happen. But it's not so. It just happened. Right? Things unfold in ways we don't always expect. I canceled the Sesshin. If you know anything about me, you know that I'm not always in Mushin. Sometimes I'm in a very vacillating state of mind. So when I was deciding whether to cancel the sit or not, I thought, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And I went around and around, and I would talk to people and say, what do you think? Should I cancel the sit? And I'd go over the numbers and... finally, I just thought, okay, we'll cancel the Sesshin because, I just don't know what's going to happen with attendance. And then for reasons I completely didn't foresee, it was a very wise decision. There's something about events which we can't understand and we can't control. And it's very, very difficult to accept that. At least it is for me. Very much like to have a clear sense of where I'm going and what I'm going to do. I really feel better if I travel, for example. I feel better if I have a plan. When my wife and I went to France, we had numerous guidebooks. And one in particular that I would highly recommend his name is Steve, his last name, Rick Steve. Very, very good book. I mean, totally great. To the point where he would say, you turn this corner and there will be a Coke machine and over here there'll be place that sells newspapers. It's amazingly up to date. Having that book made my travel experience easier. because I could get on the train at the station, he said. And I could go to, we went to, it's a train station, the Saint-Lazare train station. So I went there. Yes, just as he said, there's a train to Vernon. Catch the train to Vernon, get off, and he said, next to the train station, there's a place that rents bikes. Next to the train station, there's a place that rents bikes. We got on our bikes. He said, there's a bike path to Monet's house. So get on the bike path. It was like, thank you, Rick Steves. You know, everything went according to plan. This is a wonderful way to live your life. Unfortunately, it only works in very specialized circumstances. In most of life, it's not like that. You know, it's not like that. You know, the truth is that life is very complex and highly unpredictable and uncontrollable. And this is maybe not what you want to hear at this very minute, because some of you I know are in transit to various places. One person is going off to college and is leaving home and setting up shop in a strange city. Another person is crossing the ocean, going to India. Other people are going to India. Other people, too, have ventures going on that require, that make you nervous, right? They make you nervous. And, you know, the usual response to something like that is to say, well, you know, get a guidebook. You know? So if you're going to move to another city, you can get a book on the city, you can study the city, you know, you can get a bus route map and so on and so on. And I think you should do it. I definitely think you should do it. But, you know, much of life is not controllable, not controllable. I could have decided to have the sesshin last August. And, you know, we could have gotten down here and we could have set up and we could have done our darndest, you know, to make the sesshin happen. But we couldn't have foreseen that a hurricane was coming and that it would mean the everything to the ocean side of Route 9 would be evacuated. Because of a decree from the governor. You know, that's unforeseeable. And actually, much of life has this character. It's unforeseeable and uncontrollable. Now, this is not necessarily comforting. It's not necessarily comforting to me, you know. I like to be in charge. I like to know where things are going. When I had my Rick Steves books with me, I mean, we would carry Rick Steves everywhere we went. You know, we'd go to a town and there'd be a restaurant recommendation. Often we would take his recommendation, you know. And it was delightful, really delightful. But nevertheless, you know, sometimes life doesn't have this character of being predictable or planable. Most of life is like that. Most of life is like that. You really can't say with any certainty where you're going to be in a couple of years. You can make a guess, but the truth is you really can't know. And, you know, you could make a decision today, and then tomorrow, factors that you couldn't have foreseen will completely change everything. You know, change everything. I have a friend who had a plan, life plan, to be a doctor. And then she had an illness in her family. Her mother became ill. And she had to put off becoming a doctor and take care of her mother. And this was quite a protracted sacrifice, you know. But it completely changed her life. She never did become a doctor. She actually does research now in English on doctors and the way they interact with patients. But, you know, her life was changed by an unforeseen circumstance. And she had worked very hard in high school, gotten good MCATs, and so on and so on. But, she was faced with a dilemma. She had to take care of her ailing mother. She had to put off medical school, and then this went on and on. And by the time she was free to go back to school, she was a different person too. So this is just the way life is, and it could be the occasion for a lot of distress. I have to say that I have been sitting for 35 years, but I still like life to fit my plan. You're different, but for me, basically, I like things to fit my plan. And I like my dreams to come true, so to speak, And when my dreams don't come true, I go through a lot of stress. I do. I'm just telling you the truth. I have goals and objectives, and like anybody else, and I have a 5-year plan, and I want my dreams to come true. I want them to come true. I really badly want my dreams to come true. Everybody's like that, right? Everybody's like that. We have this capacity to imagine the future, and it's we tell ourselves, if I'm a good boy, if I do this, this is going to happen, and we do our darndest, we do our best. And yet, sometimes things just don't turn out the way we plan. And I don't know if there's anybody on earth who is so wise that this never happens to them. But for me, I usually go through a period where, there's a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, and some grief. And I do some sitting. It takes me a long time sometimes to get through that feeling of, I don't know what it's, of pushing against a brick wall, or, almost like a kind of panic when you know that what you thought was going to happen isn't going to happen. There's like a kind of, almost like a kind of panic, and then you go through all the stages of like dying, anger, denial, and finally, you really do get to like acceptance. And for me, it usually takes a zazen to do that. One of my favorite books is War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. And it really affected me. When I read it, I was about 23 years old. And Tolstoy was fascinated by war and the way war was unpredictable. And Tolstoy's novel, if you haven't had a long period of time to read 1,300 pages, is about Napoleon's invasion of Russia. And or that's one of the plots. But the hero of the story is a man named General Kutuzov. And General Kutuzov is sort of like a Zen hero in a way, because he knows that planning and strategy and logistics only take you so far. So Tolstoy has a scene in the book where he has all these young generals who are surrounding him at a meeting, at a staff meeting, and they have their maps out and their tables. And they're going through that. They have the battle laid out on a modeling table, and they're moving things around, and they're checking trajectories and things like that. And they get into these big debates, and they look over, and General Kutuzov is fast asleep, and somebody wakes him. He's Tolstoy's hero, right? Kutuzov actually says at one point, this army comes up, and this army comes up, and then it's just chaos. And then it's like the will of heaven will decide, right? The better army the better equipped army with more people can lose. You know, a chance event can trigger a massive transformation. And so Kutuzov actually has this philosophy. And by the way, Tolstoy had read Taoism. He was very familiar with Taoism. He had this idea that there's a kind of Tao, there's a kind of way of the world unfolding naturally. And that, you know, it doesn't always match our plans, but we have to trust that it will unfold as it must, you know. And so Kutuzov is really different from all the other generals because he believes that you can't really plan it all out. And in the book, Napoleon is a meticulous planner. He has a great intelligence. He's made out to be a very sort of like super genius. And Napoleon plans it all out, and he has a brilliant strategy. And Kutuzov just keeps losing to him. You know, they engage and Kutuzov loses and falls back. And they engage and Kutuzov loses and falls back. And they engage and Kutuzov loses and falls back. And everybody's thinking, what? Kutuzov is such a loser. You know, he's such a terrible general. He keeps losing. And then all of a sudden, and Napoleon is so overextended that his supply lines break down and winter comes. And then Kutuzov, who has just been retreating, letting Napoleon get farther and farther and farther into Russia, turns and decimates the invading French army. And so, you know, the story is all about a different way of dealing with life. You know, there's a kind of giving in to things as they unfold. You know, so Kutuzov loses and he just moves the troops away. And he loses and he moves the troops away. And he loses and he moves the troops away. And yet he wins the war, you know, by not trying too hard. You know? There's one moment, though, where he does lose his cool. And that's when Moscow is captured. They say, you know, he actually starts crying, you know, because even he is too invested in Moscow to give it up easily. But, you know, Tolstoy is trying to tell us something about life, and it's a mighty beautiful story, grand tapestry. But, you know, our own lives are very much like this, right? You know, and I think that Zen practice is very much like this. That, you know, the art of Zen is really trying but letting go. You know, being attuned to the kind of flow of things, right? You know, so you might come to Sesshin thinking you're going to do something, you know, going to accomplish one particular goal. And you might find that all day long you're blocked by something. You know, maybe it's something that happened to you at work. Maybe it's something that that is going on in your personal life. Maybe it's just pain in your legs, you know, and it's like defeat all day long, you know. And, you know, this is a difficult situation, but, you know, at some point, and it's usually around day two or day three of Sesshin, people begin to let go a little bit. They begin to, surrender. When you surrender, you know, when you give up, you can be intelligent, you know, maybe for the first time. You know, our desire to win, our desire to be successful, to have control, you know, when that goes down the tubes, you know, there's a kind of, it can be like a kind of like depression or panic or anger. And all of those things happen to people on the cushion, you know. But at some point, if you just keep hanging in there, you know, you encounter this, it's not, you know, I could say surrender. Surrender is a good word for it, because it's like, okay, I give up. What do you want, life? You know, what do you want, life? And life is going to tell you what it wants you to do. You know, and we don't always want to hear the instructions. But so most of the conflict in Zen is because we don't want to hear what life is saying to us, right? We don't want to hear what, and this happens to me all the time, right? This happens to me all the time. I don't want to hear what life is saying to me. And so, you know, I try to be tough, I try to be forceful, and I try to assert, you know, my will or my vision. And it doesn't work out usually. You know, when I was in graduate school, I wanted to be a Renaissance specialist, like Shakespeare. And in my department, the most impressive people were all in the Renaissance, and they seemed to know everything. You know, I studied with a man named Eric LaGuardia, whose father was the mayor of New York City. It was Fiorello LaGuardia. And Eric LaGuardia, you would go to his class, and the guy just seemed to know everything. He would just reel off, you know, Italian painting, German philosophy, you know. And it was, I would always leave just feeling like I'm hopeless, right? You know? He was so brilliant, and he knew so much. I had another mentor. His name was Gary Cox, and Gary was also like a Renaissance specialist, and he too was just very learned, and he was very polished, very suave man. You know, he was incredibly handsome. He looked like Pierce Brosnan, if you know who Pierce Brosnan is. I might be dating myself, but he might remember, you know, dark hair, very handsome man, and Gary was just always beautifully dressed, and he was my dissertation director. And so I would go and meet with Pierce Brosnan, this handsome man. And his wife was beautiful. His wife, Molly Height, was this beautiful woman. And she's now at Cornell and a very distinguished professor. So anyway, Gary was my one of my mentors, and Eric was the other. And I just wanted to be like them so much, you know. And I worked so hard. I spent so many days in the library looking out the window at Seattle, wishing I could be outside playing with my friends. After Sesshin, you know, everybody else would get in their cars. After Sesshin, all my friends would go like hiking up in the mountains. And I would have to go back and grade my papers and study for my doctoral exam. And so, you know, I made a lot of sacrifices to be a Renaissance scholar. But the year I went out on the job market, there were hardly any jobs. And I remember going to a job interview at the national conference. And I got in the elevator with somebody else who was ahead of me in the interviews. And she had her book under her arm. Right? I just thought, I'm doomed, I'm screwed, is what I thought. I'll never get it. And I didn't get the job. You know, the story in my mind was, she has a book, but I'm going to go into that room, and I'm going to wow them. And they're going to say, Spellmeyer, you don't have a book, but you've got the job, damn it. You know, right? My God, man, you're, whatever. It didn't happen, right? They politely interviewed me for in English, the code word for the interview is over is, tell them about the health benefits. That means the interview is over and we want to get rid of you. So about 25 minutes into the interview, the chairman said, oh, tell them about the health benefits. You know, that was the end. So I left feeling really crestfallen. But, you know, I had an interview at Rutgers for a job I didn't really want. They wanted somebody to run the writing program at Rutgers, which is a rather unprestigious job, and very hard work and rather thankless. And It was, you know, it's not the kind of job my mentor Garrett Cox would ever have taken, right? Anyway, I went to that interview and I didn't really care. I really didn't care. I had the best time at that interview because I went in there thinking, I don't really want this job. And I talked to the people and I found them really interesting. And one of them was a Renaissance scholar, a woman named Bridget Lyons. And she and I got along fantastically. You know, we were laughing, you know, it was just like, what a wonderful interview. And the interviewer, the chairman of the interview committee said, we want you to send us a sample of your writing. And I left and I thought, well, now what am I going to do? And I thought, maybe I can go work for Boeing as a public relations writer. And then I got a call about 3 weeks later from the chairman of the department. And he said, I thought you were going to send us a writing sample. And I hadn't even sent it because I just thought I didn't stand a chance. And he was kind of mad at me. He said, where's that sample? Get it to us right away. So I actually got it to him and they offered me a job. And it was amazing. You know, I've been doing that job for 25 years. And actually, I get up every day and I go in and I like the job. You know, I really do. I like my work. And if you had asked me, if you had asked me 27 years ago, if I wanted to direct a writing program, I would have just said, oh, absolutely not. No way. You know? But here I am 25 years later and I have done it, I think, a decent job, you know, and it's been very rewarding. So, you know, life doesn't follow our plans, and you know, often we have, we try to stick to the plan, we try to stick with the program, and holding on to the program only creates more tension and unhappiness. And when we sort of give up, when we say, okay, I give up. You know, sometimes we can begin to hear what life is saying to us, you know? And this is never easy, you know? Like in the story, when General Kutuzov is losing Moscow, he's apoplectic. He can't believe it, you know? He can't believe that life is going to do this to him, that he's going to lose Moscow. But he gets up and he goes on, you know? I couldn't believe I wasn't going to get that job at Pomona College in California. That job was mine, but the committee didn't think so, so I didn't get the job. But you know, Zen practice is very much like life, right? You know, we have to learn how to be open to the unexpected. And it's not easy being, you know, open to the unexpected. It's not easy being open to life. You know, yesterday I said that the difference between daily practice and sesshin is the difference between bathing in a bathtub and swimming in the ocean. And that is absolutely true. You know, you need to take a bath every day, but you know, you're a great sea creature, you know. And when you're in the bathtub, you're just keeping your gills wet or something, you know. You know, you belong in the big ocean, and you know, when we get to sesshin, it takes a few days to achieve that state of openness. You know, usually day one, we're still very much in the small mind, in the small self. And we're still trying to control things and to be the master. You know, on day two of sesshin, it's a different story. You know, in day three, you begin to let go. You begin to be able to go with the flow of events, with the Tao. And letting go in this intelligent way is really marvelous. You know, where you're trying to answer the koan, and all you keep thinking about all you keep thinking about is your mother. And you might say to yourself, God damn it, why do I keep thinking about my mother? I've got to answer the koan, you know. Well, and people come into Dokusan and I say, how's it going with your koan? Oh, my mind is totally distracted. And I'll say, well, what's the koan? They'll tell me the koan. I'll say, well, what's going on in your mind? They'll say, all I'm thinking about is my mother. It's like, of course, you know. That's exactly where the koan is pointing you. Right? It wants you to think about your mother, something about your mother that's related to this koan. And it's not what people expected because they were trying to go in another direction. You know, just before we had Sasheen, I've been working on an article for a couple weeks. And I was really blocked, you know. I'm a pretty diligent person. I would get up and, sit and then start writing. And I wrote many pages of what I just thought were just trash, you know. I wrote, and I was trying so hard to finish this thing, and I just did not know how to finish it. And this really happened. You know, then it was time to get ready for Sasheen, and I had to go shopping. And I was thinking about the groceries I had to get from the Asian food store, and I was thinking about other details of Sasheen. And I went out on my email just to make sure that I knew who was coming to the Sasheen, and then I went back to my document. Just thinking I was going to close it out. And I just read a few paragraphs, and I'm not kidding, it just hit me. I know exactly where to go with this. You know, I know exactly where to go with this. And I made a bunch of notes, and when I go back, I'm pretty sure that those are going to be reliable notes. I could have pounded away for hours and hours and not have come up with that solution. You know, stepping away and being open made the difference, you know. And I think Zen practice is like that too. You just have to let it go, let things go and be open. This idea of having no direction is quite important. You know, they've done research on creativity. And they find, there was just a big report on this, but they found that creativity requires a fair amount of aimless time. That when people can loaf and hang around and not have a clock ticking, running, you know, when they don't have objectives, they do some of their best work. And it said that some of the least creative workplaces are places where everybody's highly regimented and under a lot of pressure. This might sound where you work, but the study said the most creative environments actually give people time to goof around, to just explore, to read this and that, to make connections that might not pan out. And a lot of research is like that too, you know. A lot of discoveries are made by people who have time to just pursue projects that have no clear benefit to anybody. So today is day two of Sasheen, and it takes a while to learn how to surrender. It takes a while. When you let go, the most amazing thing can happen, right? You can feel like you're connected to something larger than yourself. You know, we got up this morning and we listened to the sound, those incredible sounds of the insects, right? And it's probably not something you thought about when you went to bed last night. It wasn't necessarily part of the plan. You just got up at 5 o'clock, you came in here, you sat down, And all of a sudden there's this roaring. And it's magnificent, right? Totally unexpected. And not as something you chose or could control. And if you were a little bit awake, you know, you probably found that the sound was really deeply nourishing, very deeply sustaining somehow. It's like being home. And this happens, I think, when we encounter the moment in this open way. Very hard. A lot of the trouble with our lives and with Sesshin is that we just don't like where life is going, or we don't think we like it. And so it's sort of like it's like you're being dragged in one direction by life, but you want to go in another direction. And around day two of Sesshin, people sort of get too tired to keep resisting. And then they think, well, okay, if I'm going in this direction, I ought to at least enjoy myself, or I ought to at least see where I'm going. And then you hear the insects, right? Or you hear the birds in the trees, or you see some flowers outside. You know, the Chinese had a term for this, wu-wei, wu-wei. This is like, don't try too hard, don't try too hard. And I think this is a good motto for life. You know, don't try, you know, if you don't go to college, you don't study for the exam, you're going to fail the exam. But, you know, you can study your best and sometimes not get the results you want. You know, that just happens. And sometimes you might not study as much as you think you need to and just do a brilliant job. So, try but let go. You know, try but don't try too hard. You know, and this is the secret to Zen. This is the secret, I think, to really being a happy person. You know, there are people who constantly compare themselves to others, and constantly compare what they have to what could be. And that's like a formula for abject misery. Life is really open. Life is really open in ways that we don't always appreciate. But there's a kind of creative openness to things. And that is sounds great, but actually it can be a little bit heartbreaking. Because, you know, basically life has all this potential. Life has all this potential. Life is potential. It's becoming, becoming, becoming. And so, you know, sometimes we can feel unhappy because we haven't realized our potential. Yeah. You know, you might have gone to France, and then you think, you know, you get back from France and think, I had a nice trip, and then you meet somebody who said, well, did you go to Giverny? No. What's a Giverny? Monet! Oh! Why didn't I go to Giverny? Oh, you know? So now your trip to France, which looks so good, now begins to look bad, right? Because you didn't realize the potential to have a truly wonderful experience. You know? You can do this all the time with yourself. You can say, well, you know, I went to Rutgers and I could have majored in medicine, but instead I majored in this. Why didn't I major in medicine? Make yourself very unhappy. But, you know, if life really is open, there's always roads we don't walk down in life. It's just a fact. In fact, there's infinite numbers of roads we didn't walk down. Think about that. So if you play the game with yourself of saying, why didn't I do X? If only I had done X, you're going to go crazy. Because you had infinite choices every step of the way, and you didn't take some of those choices, and they might have led to happiness and might not. But I think the art of being happy is to say, where am I now? What's happening now? and go with what's happening now. And there's infinite possibilities, but you're here now, right? At this moment, you're here now. And I think living intelligently and also happily means being open to what's unfolding at this minute. So Zen practice is like this, very much so. Shogen Osho said, "Why is it that a man of great strength does not lift his legs?" You know, I was doing the Mu Koan for years and years. And all my friends were passing the Mu Koan, and I couldn't pass the Mu Koan. And I would go into the Dokusan, and I would scream Mu. I would be literally hoarse, and Genki Roshi wouldn't pass me on Dokusan. And at one point, he said to me, "You know, you can't make things happen. You know, all you can do is knock at the door and wait for it to open." And at the time, I just, you know, that was not what I wanted to hear. But I wanted to hear, "You've passed the Mukha." But that wasn't what I heard. He said, you're trying too hard. And it was years later, I passed the Mukon. It was in our temple up in the mountains in eastern Washington. We had been building a temple up there, and we were all staying in tents, and we were sitting in the Zendo, and it had no windows. And it was too high up for mosquitoes or any insects, so it was fine. And we would work during the day, and then we'd do zazen at night, and we were all totally wiped out. It was really an incredible experience. And I remember going to bed and getting up, and I was mostly thinking about the windows we were putting in. And I was having a hard time getting the windows in because the carpenter didn't measure them right. And I wasn't sure how to nail them up, and I didn't want to screw it up, and we weren't in agreement, my partner and I, on this. And I was tired, and I was thinking about the windows, and I went into the Dokusan room, which was the kitchen. And I opened my mouth, and it was just like this thing came out. It was just like, moo. And it was just, I thought, holy crap, you know, did that come out of me? And Genki Roshi had this big smile on his face. He said, "How do you feel?" And I said, "I don't know." So, you know, I had stopped trying, and something wonderful happened. And you know, we have our dreams, we have our goals, and damn it, we wish they would work, you know. Oh. But sometimes, you know, we go with the flow, we go with the moment unfolding, and these wonderful things can happen. So please practice this on the cushion and off the cushion. You know, the important thing, I think, is to be connected to the moment in a wholehearted way. If you come to Sesshin and you practice wholeheartedly, it will be a very good Sesshin. If you come to Sesshin with terms and conditions, it will not be a good Sesshin. If you come to Sesshin with attitude of a good deal, I'll put in this energy and I'll get this out of it, that's going to be like a disastrous Sesshin. So the proper spirit for practice is the mind that just says, whatever happens, I'm going to be one with it. My teacher in Japan, the temple where he trained, there was a wash basin in the temple. And the characters on the basin were, "I only wholeness know. I only know wholeness." That's so hard to say sometimes, right? This is, "I only know wholeness." But that's the proper mind for Sashin.